KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher is on sabbatical until October. The apocalypse, it's on the minds of Hollywood filmmakers, from zombie apocalypse to maybe teenage burglary apocalypse. Film critic Robert Horton joins us later this hour. We're also going to talk business. Michelle Matassa, Flores of the Puget Sound Business Journal, will join us. Canadians have been waiting for the arrest of the mayor of Toronto. Well, surprise, Montreal's mayor got nabbed first. Vaughn Palmer joins us once again with details on this story and more. Hello, Vaughn.
Hi, Marcy.
Okay, so what happened to the Montreal mayor?
What the heck's going on up here?
Yes.
I think that's legit to ask. Real spreading political scandal in the province of Quebec. The thing with the mayor of Toronto, which he denies a video that supposedly exists of him smoking crack cocaine, it's kind of blown over a bit. A lot of people don't think the video even exists. And anyway, we've moved on from that. The problem in the province of Quebec is actually a much bigger scandal. It's been going on for a while, and it's a local government corruption scandal that has claimed its latest victim, the mayor of Montreal. He was arrested this week. He was charged with 14 counts related to bribery, tens of thousands of dollar allegations. So he's arrested at his house this week. He resigns, this mayor, Michael Applebaum. And the really awful part of this story is that this was the guy who was brought in after the previous mayor had to step down last fall in the same massive corruption scandal that is ongoing in Quebec that is being unfolded in front of a public inquiry.
Now, it's very complicated. It involves construction bribes, right?
Yeah, basically the allegation. I think we're way beyond the allegation stage at this point. The criminal charges and arrests and resignations involve what are long-standing arrangements in the province of Quebec where you had kind of a three-way corruption, kinds of corruption. Local government contracts to build things, sewers, roads, things like that. Politicians and political parties being given bribes to award these contracts to particular companies. And then the additional web of organized crime being involved in the companies and the workers who are doing it. So it's a real mess in the construction industry in Quebec and local government in Quebec, and it's already claimed a number of victims.
Now, what does this town Laval have to do with it? It sounds like it centers around it.
Yeah, well, Laval is a suburb of Montreal, and as it happened, that was sort of the first place where we really got the aha moments in this. You had a lawyer who was involved in the political party in Laval. We're talking pretty big sums of money. He turned in to the inquiry when he appeared last week $720,000 in cash.
Yeah.
Like cash wrapped up in plastic, right? You see this in the movies and in the crime shows on TV.
But not in Canada.
But he brings it in. Well, not only that, he just brings it in. Okay, here you go. You want evidence? Here's evidence. $720,000 in Canadian bills. We don't know if they were marked or unmarked. But this was the cash that was used. This was what was left of the slush fund that was created by the bribes and the kickbacks in Laval.
Which is a suburb of Montreal.
Yes.
So this is province-wide.
It's scattered all over Quebec. I mean, you don't want to say that every local government in Quebec that is implicated because, you know, we're sticking to the ones where we've actually had charges and people have had to step down. But it's clear that it was widespread. Hmm. It's been rumored and talked about in Quebec for a long time. There was an inquiry way back in the 70s into this. It was thought that they'd kind of put it behind them, and then a series of investigative stories by Radio Canada, which is the French language branch of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, exposed all this, and the government ordered an inquiry. There was a lot of resistance to lifting up the lid on this because of the fear of what they would find, and we can now see why there was so much resistance, because what's come out is a pattern of corruption that goes way beyond one individual or one community.
Who is, by the way, conducting the inquiry?
Judge from the province of Quebec, full powers for public inquiry. It's the Charbonneau Commission, and they give them the power to call witnesses, take testimony, cross-examine everything. Basically, it's a pretty big operation.
It's fascinating. Well, we're going to stay in Quebec because last week we talked about how the Quebec Soccer Federation had banned the wearing of turbans, which caused the Canadian Soccer Federation to say that all these kids in Quebec couldn't compete in soccer tournaments. Well, that all changed over the weekend.
Yes, the Quebec Soccer Federation seized on a ruling by the International Federation that turbans were not an issue if, you know, reasonable and permitted by the referees and all that. And basically, it provided them with a face-saving out. The Quebec Association didn't want to be pushed around by the Canadian Association. It's bound up in ideas of Quebec sovereignty, but in this case, they've backed away. They're allowing the turbans. The Sikh community, of course, breathing a sigh of relief. Their kids get to play soccer, and the kids are no longer being used as a pawn in a kind of a stupid, messy thing between adults.
Well, I'm glad for the kids of Quebec. We're now moving to the other side of the country, British Columbia, and more specifically Vancouver. And yesterday we had news in this country that the Army Corps of Engineers was not going to think about climate change in its study of the location of ports, coal terminal ports. But In Vancouver, Metro Vancouver is forging ahead, saying, yes, we're going to consider climate change, and they are opposing a coal terminal that's proposed for the Fraser-Surrey docks.
Yeah, so there's a huge push on, as you know, to get more coal shipped to Asia through new or expanded coal ports on the West Coast. And there are several coal shipment terminals in and around Vancouver that are already pretty active. Most of what they ship, not all, is Canadian coal, metallurgical coal used in steel making from mines in Canada. But increasingly, because of the rail links across the border, there's pressure on for them to take coal from the United States. The governor of Wyoming has been out to British Columbia talking up this idea. There's serious proposals to expand coal shipments. And the same backlash you're seeing on the American side of the border, twofold. One, coal and coal dust and health concerns about port expansion. And the other, global warming. You don't get as much protest about metallurgical coal because it's not being burned to generate electricity. It is being used to make steel. There is a lot more backlash over thermal coal. And added to that in and around Vancouver, it's our port taking American coal, a perception, Marcy, on this side of the border that the reason we're being asked to take it is because of there's so much resistance to this in Washington and Oregon.
Who are Metro Vancouver?
It's the regional government for the city of Vancouver. It's a little like an American county.
Okay.
They don't actually have the power to stop this, but they're expressing a pretty strong opinion on the part of local residents. This is a very tough decision for the Canadian authorities because these ports are obviously a big part of jobs and economic development, and blocking shipments through them of coal. At the same time, we're arguing about whether or not we want to ship oil. Like, increasingly, there's a tension around Canada's West Coast ports and the communities that live around them.
Now, immediately after this resolution was passed, a group that is called the Coal Alliance renounced it. Who are they?
Well, the Coal Alliance are the people that want increased coal shipments through Vancouver. They're putting up a you know, it's a raging debate in and around Vancouver and these coal ports, and there's several of them, so you hear different names at different times. But the pressure is on to expand the port and ship goods through it. Debate in Canada is it's not just whether we take coal from the United States; it's whether you can really limit the expansion of the ports around Vancouver just because the residents living next to them don't like the goods that are being shipped through. And I guess that's kind of an argument that I suspect would be familiar on the American side
yes,
of the border.
Yes, but I'm just recalling a few weeks back when Christy Clark got reelected, did she not promise to use the environment as a big factor in weighing any kind of port expansions?
She did promise that on one particular pipeline that would go through British Columbia, but she also got elected on a promise of jobs and economic development and not saying no to everything. So it's a balancing act for her. It's a balancing act for politicians on both sides of the border. But the coal shipment issue is part of a bigger issue. And as I said, everybody in and around Vancouver is following the argument south of the border, too, because, well, you tell me, do you think they're going to be able to ship the coal through Washington and Oregon?
Well, our governor told me this very morning that the state of Washington has, if not authority to supersede the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, they have what he said is we have our own set of standards that we use for evaluating, and we will use those standards.
And the dilemma there is, as it is here, I suspect, is whose ports and whose coast is it really? Does it belong to the whole country, or does it just belong to the people who live there, who may take a different view about exports than, say, the landlocked provinces of Canada or the landlocked states of the United States? I mean, where's Wyoming supposed to sell its coal if it can't send its coal through adjacent states?
Well, I'm sure that this is not the final word on this subject, Vaughn. We'll be talking about it again. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Marcy. And I do find it interesting how it's playing out similarly on both sides of the border.
I do as well. Vaughn Palmer writes for the Vancouver Sun. He's a regular Wednesday guest here on Weekday on KUOW.
KUOW 1019. Our film critic buddy Robert Horton is here to talk about movies in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, renewing their commitment during June's National Dairy Month to healthy cows, product quality, and a clean environment. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
Fifty-six degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. Expecting a little bit of sun this afternoon, a continuing chance of showers, and a high of 70. How's the race for Seattle's next mayor shaping up with the local business community? We'll get into that and other local business issues in 20 minutes.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Yes, time to be planning your weekend trip to the movies. And film critic Robert Horton joins us once again. Today we're not talking summer fun. It is the apocalypse.
I'm afraid so.
It's upon us. I was at the Sundance Cinema in Seattle this weekend, which I have to say has discount lobby treats right now because they're under renovation, which was fun in and of itself. But I saw a trailer for the long-discussed Brad Pitt project, which is called World War Z.
Yes, or World War Z, if you're in England.
Is it made in England?
No.
Okay, so it's Z.
You know how those people are, though.
I do. They call it a Z, and Z stands for zombie.
In this case, yes.
In most cases.
In many
anymore,
cases,
it seems like zombies are
yes,
it.
Yes.
This seems like a project that, if I'm not mistaken, Brad Pitt's been kind of trying to shepherd through for years.
Yeah. Well, it was a novel by Max Brooks, which I never did get around to reading, but I understand the movie has changed it a lot.
So don't bother.
Maybe it doesn't matter, I guess. But the title's pretty good, I think you'll agree. And so, yeah, somebody thought it would be a good good property. Brad Pitt obviously thought so.
So zombies take over the world, I'm assuming. That's my assumption from watching the trailer, which had a lot of CG teeming people.
There is a contagion going on. Uh-huh. And yes, it's bad because if the zombies, if you see them running down the street in Philadelphia, which is where this begins, the problem is that they bite people, as zombies do, and it only takes about 10 seconds or so for that person to you know, die and then be reborn as a zombie who will then go to the next person and kill them. And so it's a very fast spreading
zombie
sort of zombie virus.
I didn't realize zombies bit people. I thought that was werewolves.
Well,
so in this movie they
zombies bite. Zombies are hungry. That's really what they're doing. That's all they're doing.
And so this is sort of Brad Pitt saving the world. Is that what,
yeah,
single-handedly?
It's a little unclear. He's retired at the beginning of the movie, but then he gets called back into service. And I was never quite sure what his service was, but it had something to do with saving the world. Like in the past, he was a guy who parachutes into places and fixes problems. And this is a huge, huge problem. Well, I think you'll agree.
The zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In that same trailer stream, the next one I saw was called White House Down, which is a similar apocalyptic thing. No zombies, I don't think.
No zombies, as far as I know. Yeah.
You haven't seen it?
I'll see it next week.
You'll see that. And that's a movie where somebody takes over the White House, as near as I could discern. And the White House is under siege.
Yes.
So, siege.
Not to be confused with Olympus Has Fallen, which came out 2 months ago and was on the same subject.
The White House?
Yes, the president was taken hostage.
Uh-huh. So what is it about this sort of siege mentality?
There's a strange thing going on. Even in the last week's Superman movie, they had to destroy half of Metropolis for Superman to get his stuff done, which has caused some unease in, you know, people talking about the film and thinking, gee, it's a great Superman movie. Millions of people seem to have died, but don't let that, you know, harsh your vibe on a nice summer movie. There is a kind of apocalyptic strain happening, and World War Z might be the most explicit one of that. And this one, too, I don't think it's giving too much of a way to say that it's planned as clearly the studio wants it to be a series of films so you can have sequels in coming years, so not everything is going to get wrapped up at the end, you know. We're not going to quite...
The world is not safe.
Yeah, and we haven't eradicated all the zombies yet.
Does it strike you that these are similar to the sort of invasion from outer space movies of the 1950s during the Cold War?
Well, there is some kind of... I mean, there is something about clusters of movies that start, you know, blooming at certain times. And you think, why is this happening? And it's a weird... phenomenon. I used the word contagion a couple minutes ago, and there was a movie that came out a year or two.
Called Contagion, right?
Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh film that was pretty effective and it was, you know, about a virus. But it is about one of the, it is interesting that there's this kind of worry about some sort of fast striking, in that case, a virus. There's also been these climate change films like The Day After Tomorrow, which was a couple of years ago now. In which things seem like they could happen much, much faster than we thought. You know, like there's this thread of just sort of sudden change, a sudden loss of everything we've known. It is a weird sort of anxiety that seems to be floating around out there.
Well, I'm assuming that Hollywood responds always to some zeitgeist, maybe late, but they're responding cultural zeitgeist or something that they see.
Yeah, and, you know, audiences are dictating part of that, and they're choosing to see these kinds of movies. But we'll see if World War Z is a hit, because it's been much worried about in Hollywood. Apparently it was a very, very expensive kind of runaway production. So,
well, a lot of CG, because these teeming people trying to escape their zombie, being fenced in by the zombies, seems to me, it looked like CG.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't say it looks
CGI,
but it certainly did, because you can't have tens of thousands of people crawling up each other like ants
No.
and have it be real.
There are union regulations.
I would assume so.
It's interesting because a number of films that, you know, we're talking about movies that either sort of unconsciously react to the zeitgeist, as you were saying, but then also movies that kind of are trying to touch things. Like this film, World War Z, I think there's a whole long sequence that set in Jerusalem, of all places, where it's spoken about that the Israelis have erected giant walls. Therefore, they're actually kind of ready for the zombie apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And clearly somebody along the line was probably trying to draw an allegorical strand or two. It's not quite as blatant as I'm making it sound, because it actually works out in some interesting and sometimes ironic ways. But somebody obviously was, you know, thinking, gee, zombie apocalypse, how can we use that to have some ideas in our movie as well? And I'm not sure that quite worked out. But actually, the movie itself is not bad. It's I'm seeing it in the wake of Man of Steel, and so it looks better compared to that movie, which you and I snobbishly talked about last week.
Well, we were accused of snobbery. I didn't see it, but my coworker, Jamala Henderson, did, and she tweeted out that it was better than she thought it would be. But she kept in mind your words that Russell Crowe had outacted everybody else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I didn't care for that one, but I have to say that World War Z has a kind of a stripped down, even with all of the CGI people, there is a sort of through line that's quite intense, and for what it is, I think it carries that through pretty well. It's a sustained suspense piece, and not bad. And they didn't have to destroy a giant city at the end. They actually came up with
maybe they're saving that for...
That may be for part, yes, Z2.
We're talking with Robert Horton, and I'm curious, listeners, if, you know, we were talking last week about summer film fair, and big suspense films are also often summer fair, even though they're light. So you can email us weekday@kuow.org if you're feeling in an apocalyptic mood. But I'm also thinking about zombies, because haven't they jumped the shark, as they say? Isn't that the expression? Shouldn't we be done with zombies and moving on to something else?
Well, I hope not. I hope
you like zombies.
Entirely. Well, oh. I'm also known as the co-author of a graphic novel about zombies.
You are.
I try to eke a little bit out of that.
I see.
Which is called Rotten, by the way. But we'll see. It's funny because it's had more staying power, I think, than anybody thought. 5 years ago, people were starting to generate stories about zombies, and it seemed sort of interesting. But there's something has caught on, and it's catching something, and people are still into it.
Well, we have zombies on TV. We have Pride and Prejudice and zombies. I mean, once you connect a zombie to Jane Austen,
if you drag that in, yes.
I don't know where we are as a culture. What does that say?
Where do you take it after that?
Yeah, what does that say about us as a culture?
Well,
zombies. You wrote a book about zombies.
A lot of people have thought that in some ways it's a kind of, it works on a lot of different fears, including the kind of, one thing about zombies is that they're mindless, and that there's sort of a fear of being overwhelmed by maybe a culture that's mindless, or being turned into one of those peoples, which is the fear of zombie things, that you're going to become one of them.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're going to bite you, and you'll be subsumed into... You'll still be alive, but you're sort of undead alive. But the weird, you know, scary thing is that you won't have your mind anymore. You'll just be... I mean, that's the horror of it. Not that you would die, because that would be okay, but that you would actually, still be alive and be at the mercy of these things. And... I was talking to a friend last night who thought that it's about a culture in which so many people are mindless that it's just kind of overwhelming at a certain point.
That's like the oat analysis of zombiedom, isn't it?
I think it's definitely one of them, yeah. That particular fear that everybody is either not thinking or is kind of thinking alike in some horrible group mentality way that's just voracious.
Oh, my. Tomorrow we're talking with political writer Jonathan Alter.
He loves zombies. So
I was mostly thinking about his analysis of Congress So you, I'm drawing parallels in my mind here.
Oh,
and,
I don't, yeah.
You can infer. So let's go. Listeners, if you've got some zombie comments, please feel free to join us at 206-543-5869. But the other movie that opened this week is could be termed apocalyptic in a different sense. Teenage girls run riot in Beverly Hills, I believe.
Near there, yeah, yeah.
This is the Bling Ring.
You might even bring in zombies.
Do you think there's zombies there?
And it's not just girls. Okay. It's
zombie also, teenagers.
Zombie teenagers, yeah. It's The Bling Ring is the new film by Sofia Coppola, and it's taken off a fairly recent story, I think, 2008, 2009, that these kids, very privileged kids in Southern California, were sort of, because you can Google celebrities and their home addresses and things, and you can figure out that Paris Hilton is going to be out of town for 2 weeks at the something festival. Why don't we go to her house and break in and take stuff? And they did. This
is based on a true story,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, they really did it. And it's a bunch of teen burglars. And in some cases, or at least the movie suggests that it wasn't even about like getting the bling. It was just, why don't we just walk around Lindsay Lohan's house? Wouldn't that be awesome? You know, to be like Lindsay and maybe put her perfume on or something like that. And that's what they do. And that's what the Bling Ring is about, is sort of this affectless group of youths.
Zombie youths,
yeah.
We have some listeners who want to join our conversation. So please don those headphones, Mr. Horton. And we go to downtown Seattle. Jim joins us. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if my sense of it is that the invasion of the body snatchers was sort of a version of the zombie concept, so to speak. So my question is, are you aware of whether or not that essentially that first invasion of the body snatchers movie that's the most famous, iconic, unless there are other versions which I don't know about. Anyway, is that body snatcher movie, did it predate the zombie concept such that perhaps people said, well, we can't exactly redo the body snatchers movies forever, but how about we just take that concept of people kind of having that glaze in their eyes and transpose that into a different concept? Oh, hey, how about the zombie concept? I mean, what is the derivation of this?
Yeah.
Like, you could go back to Dracula in being the vampire thing. I think that goes back to, like, the Dark Ages of Romania or something. Does the zombie concept go back to some sort of, medieval times?
Well, I bet it does.
Yeah. One thing, just to note, the Invasion of the Body Snatchers has been remade a few times because it's such a great concept that it seems to be durable for different eras. But the zombies in full force go back to the late 19th century, mostly, specifically legends that are associated with the Caribbean islands and places like that. And then they sort of got some popularity in the late 1920s when a guy wrote a book about his journeys in the Caribbean and things that he'd seen down there. So the thought of it existed, but it didn't come into full force until Night of the Living Dead, probably in the late 1960s, kind of kicked off this string. So I don't think there's a direct,
vampires and zombies, not the same.
Family tree there, except that they're all, a lot of them have similarities, especially the idea of somehow having your body or your personality taken over, losing control of your body or your mind is a fear that connects a lot of different horror concepts, I think.
Jim, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Kenmore, where Aylin's on the line. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I was mentioning to the zombies. I think that in our culture, we're seeing zombies as a result of how we feel, that it's showing us just being another cog in a meaningless 1984 society, especially with overpopulation and unemployment. Zombies really make their kind of, that's our fear, becoming nothing, becoming this rotting thing in culture. And I think that's what's how it's playing itself out with us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, and those kinds of ideas do go in cycles, you know, and sometimes that will manifest itself one way, and in this sort of if it is a cycle of disillusionment or that fear of becoming a cog, like you said, somehow the zombies are this is the turn in the cycle for the zombies because they weren't quite so big previously. Back in the 70s, there was, after Night of Living Dead, there was a great movie, Dawn of the Dead,
mm-hmm.
that had the zombies kind of sequestered in a shopping mall. And it was said that they were brain dead, but they were going back to the places where they felt comfortable. So you had these visions of people stalking through the shopping mall.
Wait, looking, that's the Bling Ring.
Looking a lot like, yes, almost any mall you might want to pick out, including the Southern California, the Bling Ring. That's right.
Oh, Aylin, thanks for that call. Interesting. This, you know, zombies can be comedic, and we have a lot of zombie comedies.
Yes.
We have zombie fright things. After you sell the appropriate number of books, I wonder, will we move on from this? And mm-hmm. Where do you go? Yeah. I mean, we have werewolves and vampires cavorting in forks for the, I don't even know how many Twilight movies there were, but a lot of Twilight movies. Witches and wizards and giants and Harry Potter.
Yeah, fantasy comes back once in a while,
And hobbits and all that stuff.
I wish I knew which what's going to be the next thing.
Because you could capitalize on
yes,
it.
That's right. I think there will be a cycle to this, and zombies will usher out. And I'm sure, you know, when World War Z opens, there will be some sort of people on Monday will be making pronouncements about whether the zombie thing is dead or whether it looks like, you know, there might still be some life in there, depending on what the number is that comes in off that, because this is certainly the most high-profile movie that's incorporated the Zeeks into its storyline. That's what they call them in this movie.
Not Zeeks. The Zeds, they're Zeeks.
Yeah, Zeeks. I think that's military jargon, at least according to this film.
For zombies.
Yes, yes.
Okay. I'm trying to
give people information here.
Okay. World War Z with Brad Pitt is the movie. Tony says zombies are hordes of mindless consumers, literally wrecking the planet, no less. You can go see them. You can go see the Bling Ring, or you can stay home and read the book World War Z, which Tamara says bears little relation to the film beyond the title. It's actually a quite brilliant look at how different people, countries, and cultures deal with a massive outbreak, really of any kind. In the book, the zombie event is 10 years in the past, and the events are oral history.
Mm-hmm.
So stay home and read. Robert Horton writes about film and culture for the Everett Herald and his website, The Crop Duster. He hosts the monthly discussion series Magic Lantern at the Fry Art Museum, and he's here with us Wednesdays on Weekday. Always glad to have you.
Thanks, Marcy.
Whether it's zombies or not.
Mostly when it's zombies, though. 56 degrees in Seattle with clouds. Expecting a little bit of sun today and some showers and a high of 70.
Today, exploring the wilds of New York City.
So we're going to sneak in right over here.
With someone who's working to protect the city's native species by collecting their seeds.
So this is Juncus gerardii, a salt marsh rush.
Seed banking in New York City later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to 17 destinations in the Middle East. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
I'm Bernard Willett. It's 10:40. Huge protests continue in Brazil, where people are upset about everything from the cost of living to government corruption. We'll get an update in 20 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. A big brouhaha earlier this month over the issue of internships. A federal judge ruled that Fox Searchlight Pictures violated the law by using unpaid interns on the film Black Swan. Should everybody get paid for their labor? Is there inherent value to on-the-job experience, learning from a professional? Michelle Matassa Flores joins us now. She's managing editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal. Do you guys use interns?
We do, Marcy. Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you here. Interns, this is sort of the standard practice in many businesses. You go out in the summer in college, you get some two-month experience,
right,
and then you have that on a resume.
Yeah, it's become almost a rite of passage in a lot of fields. And this one kind of hit home for me, especially given the timing. I had just been out to the University of Washington speaking to a journalism class there, and it came up that we were looking for our summer intern, and the professor, who's somebody I used to work with at the time, Seattle Times, said to the class with like glee in her voice, "And this is a paid internship." And they oohed and aahed like they couldn't believe we had a paid internship. I thought it was really sad.
Yeah.
And it struck me. And we had been kind of debating a little bit in our newsroom about whether to add some unpaid interns. And that debate will probably still go on.
This particular lawsuit, as I understand it, applied to this specific Black Swan case. But do you think that it will have a wider resonance among businesses that do take on unpaid interns?
Well, that to me is the interesting thing to watch now. And I kind of wonder, the coverage I saw of it hinted that it could. This is the Southern District of New York, federal court in New York. And the judge is fairly influential, I guess. There are a couple other lawsuits right now pending. In a legal way, this doesn't have implications beyond that district of the federal court. But it could. There are various ways it could catch on. One, just through pressure. Mm-hmm. Political pressure. Another is if there's an appeal or, you know, some legal step that takes it broader. I am a little bit pessimistic that it would have much of an effect, to be honest. I think the economic forces are a lot stronger. But I'm kind of rooting for the interns, even though we've talked about using unpaid interns. I also know that with the paid intern we have, we're always talking about whether we're giving them enough education versus just using them and abusing them for our own purposes.
Well, and it's a different kind of thing. I mean, maybe it causes businesses or nonprofits or journalistic enterprises, which some people say are no profit anymore, to think about what are you providing? If you're
That's
not
right.
paying money, is it like a class? We have had people come in from the University of Washington, to which we are licensed, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
We're licensed to the state of Washington. So we do have University of Washington journalism students come in and get credit
yeah.
for working for free, which I suppose is a kind of pay since those
yeah,
are...
Yeah, that's how we would do it, too. And I think a lot of places do, but others don't even offer that. It's just the wonderful experience those interns are going to get. And often, just like in the Black Swan case, from what I've read, you know, it's more grabbing lunch for everybody and delivering coffee and everything. That's no kind of experience. I mean, it's something for a resume, I suppose. But really, you ought to be almost developing like a curriculum for those interns, mm-hmm. whether it's 3 months or 6 months or however long they're with you. And like in our case, just because that's the field I know, we want to make sure they learn how to do, you know, basic types of business journalism stories and how to interview people and how to write something for the web and how to write something for the printed paper, you know, like a class.
And a little bit of the ethics of the profession as well.
Right.
There are still some ethics in journalism.
We hope.
We hope. Well, across the pond in France, in Paris, the air show is going on. And over the weekend, we had news about the assembly or the likely location of the assembly of the 787X10 to move from Everett to South Carolina because the plant's bigger. Ray Conner was kind of non-committal.
Right.
Right now, what we're hearing every day are, you know, this many orders of 737s,
yeah,
this many orders of this, you know.
Order race.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think, to me, it was that news over the weekend that really kind of shook the cages.
Yeah. I've been watching these shows now for a lot of years from a distance. I haven't had the privilege of going. And it does. What's striking to me is the typical order game that goes on over there, and they're trying to play games of one-upsmanship, but with announcements. Usually, when Boeing scores one, there's huge reason for celebration here, and I think there still is, of course, but there's a little bit of a pall cast over that right now because of all this uncertainty over Seattle versus South Carolina in particular, and a certain amount of production is already taking place down there. The big question is whether final assembly of the next generation 787s will take place down there.
As I understand it, this plane is so large that, I mean, part of the problem with the 787, the first version of it, you know, they were bringing the parts in from all over the world where they were making these things that initially, you remember, they put them together and they didn't fit.
Yeah.
So it seems, I suppose, if I were running a business, logically, maybe you'd want everything to happen in the same place, put it together.
Sounds logical.
And send it out. But this thing is huge. As I understand it,
yeah,
you can't fit the whole plane in the two hangars.
Yeah. Oh, and that, yeah. There are a couple issues going on. One is the size of the hangars where they're being assembled, and South Carolina's hangar is bigger.
Yeah.
The other is transporting the partially assembled plane to wherever it'll be going through final assembly. And that's the issue that Ray Connor was talking about this weekend, or he was asked about and didn't really talk about.
No, but he didn't say, yay, Washington State, I'm committed to you.
No, and Boeing, you know, ever since they moved to Chicago, really, they've taken a more distant approach to Puget Sound. And they even said when they moved that that was part of why they were moving, is to be a little less emotionally connected to this area, which is the kind of the gut punch that you feel here.
Well, there were announcements earlier this spring about layoffs in the engineering or relocations of a lot of folks in tech and engineering. And that's those are very well-paid jobs.
Yes, very well-paid, highly trained. And, you know, so much about the future of the company when it gets to the engineering. I think that one hit home. It also came at a time when, you know, the 787 battery issues were in the news. And so people were concerned about the design of planes and how they're put together and the whole outsourcing issue. And people feel very a possessive feeling about that work that's done here, a pride in it, and feel like they can do it better.
Well, it's also defined the Seattle area or the Puget Sound region.
Yeah, city.
Forever.
Yeah.
I mean, since Boeing was.
That's right. The Sonics.
Yeah. Michelle Mutessa Flores is with us. She's managing editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal. Just a last question about the Paris Air Show. Airbus rolled out its, you know, new competitor and got orders. I think if they did a flyover, they'd finish the plane, you know, the week before the Paris Air Show.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier in the week, we were talking about this with somebody from Aviation Week, and this Paris Air Show is in Airbus's backyard, so it seems like it'd be easier for them to sort of dominate the bread and circus part of the event.
Well, I missed the Aviation Week interview, so I don't know what that person said. I've never really felt that way watching it from a distance. You know, it seems Boeing gets plenty of attention, gets plenty of crowd over there. You know, Washington State sends a huge delegation, 50 people this year.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And perhaps they ran into the Seattle area's best new emigres, the Mastros.
That's right.
Who the 88-year-old Mr. Mastro and his wife fled the country after declaring bankruptcy and escaping with, you know, oodles of assets. And a French judge, I believe, not a court, recently denied extradition to the United States, or maybe allowed them to stay in France, is a way to put it, because they're now going to live there till they die.
Yeah, they've got it pretty rough, it sounds like, don't you think?
Well, remind us why this couple left here in the first place.
This just feels like a movie in the making to me.
Oh, yes.
They went, this was the Mike Mastro was a developer who had investors and got in too deep and basically lost $250 million of their money, owed them money. And decided, filed for personal bankruptcy, and a trustee here was going after their assets in order to pay off all the creditors, investors and others. Mike Mastro and his wife skipped the country. They went to France and then were brought up on charges of fraud. They took with them, you know, $1.5 million worth of diamond rings.
Right.
they were hiding. They were rumored to have other possessions that they were hiding from the bankruptcy trustee, and stayed there for about a year and a half before they were even found. And you know, they've claimed health reasons and all kinds of other things for not coming back, which may be true. They're
old,
you know, quite elderly. And yet they're over there now saying, well, this is all the bankruptcy trustee's fault for going after us so hard. If it weren't for him, we could have come back to the country. They're kind of playing a sympathy card. And I just don't know if that's going over all that well with people. They were literally, the day their extradition was rejected, they were going to go out to dinner in France and celebrate, their lawyer said, in this little village where they are, which is, it was called Disneyland for Adults in one article.
Well, I thought that the French reaction was kind of interesting, because I read an article that essentially the judge refused to extradite them to the United States, saying they were old and infirm, and they should be able to live out their life in peace. But most of the French public who were queried about this were in agreement with the judge. They thought, you know, why are you Americans picking on these Mastros?
Right. It felt pretty European to me, in the sense of I want to live in Europe, that kind of sense where you get to take afternoon naps and not work as many days out of the year.
That sounds great to me. And so you can take your diamonds, Michelle, and fly
Thank
over
you.
There.
I'll do that.
Your large rings. Closer to home now, the Mastros are not coming back. We'll leave them there, and their creditors can figure out how they're going to do that. Here in the Seattle area, in Seattle itself, actually, in August, we are having a primary, and on that primary ballot will be 9 candidates for mayor. And Knut Berger of Crosscut described this as a mushy race, that there was not a lot of distinguishing between candidates. But people are trying, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about these candidates in the business community, because it had seemed up until he dropped out of the race that Tim Burgess, Seattle City Council member, was the guy that they liked. So who has replaced Burgess?
Well, since he dropped out, Ed Murray has been coming on strong in terms of fundraising and has some business support and is picking up support from former Greg Nichols staffers and supporters. But oddly, you know, I think Mike McGinn is doing pretty darn well. And it's ironic, maybe, because when Burgess dropped out, he cited as one reason that he didn't want to split the vote for those who would oppose McGinn. But I don't know. I think it might work in McGinn's favor. This race is really only just beginning. I'm with Knut. It's been mushy and pretty boring.
Well, because there's not a lot to distinguish, with the exception of Mary Martin, the Socialist Workers Party candidate, who has a distinct agenda that is different. When we have our Friday roundtables and we ask the panelists to try to differentiate between these candidates, everybody's sort of a Democrat and they're sort of liberal and they're sort of for the same things.
Yeah.
And so I guess that raises the question, what kind of candidate is the business community looking for? What does the business community want?
Well, that's kind of a good question. I mean, the issues that they care about are fairly well known, including land use and zoning and South Lake Union, big on police reform and accountability and kind of cleaning up downtown, the waterfront redevelopment. But in terms of who they're really standing behind, they've been really holding back. And I thought part of that was just with Burgess in the race, especially kind of waiting to see how things shook out. And I really kind of felt like by now, after Burgess got out, they'd be in a little bit bigger. But I think that's about to start happening. You know, you saw Murray, his hands were tied a little bit with the legislature still in session, and he couldn't raise money directly on his own. So a committee formed and started raising money, and that picked up steam pretty fast.
Well, you mentioned Mike McGinn, and you talk about South Lake Union. And under Mike McGinn's tenure, South Lake Union development has had a big supporter. He is an advocate for increased density, for taller buildings, for infrastructure in that region. We're seeing two-way Mercer did not start under Mayor McGinn's mm-hmm. tenure, but it's being carried out under his tenure. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure how long people's memories are when it comes to, you know, who laid the groundwork for what's going on there. I think it was Greg Nichols, actually, mm-hmm. or maybe preceded that. But everything that you know, Amazon's building buildings all over the place in downtown Seattle and under this mayor.
Yeah, that has to play, I think, in McGinn's favor, too. Not that he can really take credit for what Amazon's doing. But he, it seems like he is doing a lot more now to try to appeal to the business community and also just kind of mainstream grown-up voters. Not the, you know, ragtag bicycle crowd or whatever you'd call that.
You mean the ones who elected him last
time? Yeah, exactly. I think he finally realized he needed to win those people over, act a little more mayoral or whatever, not just oppose everything. He'd gotten a reputation for just being a naysayer with the waterfront tunnel and all that. So now, you know, he's doing, God, it feels like a press conference two a day. I started to say one a day. He's, you know, touting high fiber internet access and transportation initiatives right and left. And he is, you know, working with Vulcan and South Lake Union and trying to kind of stand up and take credit for things. I'm not saying wrongfully, but he's just being much more proactive that way. He didn't used to do those things.
What is your sense of the biggest concerns facing Seattle's business community right now?
Well, I think transportation and the police issue, especially as it relates to how comfortable people feel downtown. Although that hasn't stopped business from booming here.
I was just going to ask you, retail and construction are up.
Hugely.
Hugely.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's more of an image thing that they look at. And for a while, image in terms of, you know, tourists come to town and they get panhandled or whatever and they don't feel comfortable in downtown. And no chamber of commerce likes that to be out there. There was talk even for a while of Ma Dadon, the head of the chamber, running for mayor. She was deputy mayor before. And then she opted out. They have yet to endorse, but they will be endorsing. It'll be interesting to see.
Do you think that they're going to make that endorsement before the primary, or are they going to wait to see who it shakes down to?
Gosh, I thought they were doing it before the primary, but now I'm not confident. I think they are.
I shouldn't have sprung that question
That's
on
okay.
you.
I should know.
Well, you know, it's hard to choose as a voter. And just by the way, we are going to be, and the conversation, we're going to be talking to all nine of those candidates in the month of July.
Busy month.
They'll all be in here. I think they've all responded at this point. And so you'll get a chance to hear from them. Newspapers are profiling them as well. But that's a lot of candidates to choose from.
Yes, it is.
Well, we'll be reading your paper to see what business community has to say and other great stories. Thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle Matassa-Flores is managing editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal. We are produced here at Weekday by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Alsadi. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer, the man at the helm, the master of this little universe that we create. And Bernard, we'll be seeing
Keep
you again.
Going, Marcy.
Yeah, you are all. Tomorrow, we're going to meet the person who replaces Spate Jenkins at Seattle Opera, as if anybody could replace Spate Jenkins. But the new opera general director joins us. And we're also going to talk about the 2012 presidential election with political reporter Jonathan Alter. Got a new book out.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Weekday program, which airs from 9 to 11 a.m. Strong words from Senator Patty Murray on a controversial abortion bill passed last night by the U.S. House. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from KCTS9, presenting Coal, a documentary about the debate over building coal export terminals in the Northwest. KCTS9 and EarthFix follow coal's path from Wyoming's open-pit mines to the proposed ports. Coal premieres tonight at 7:30 on KCTS9 and online.
NSA leaker Edward Snowden could strain relations between Hong Kong and mainland China.
If the whole system does not measure up, there's going to be hell to pay.
Emily Lau, chairperson of Hong Kong's Democratic Party, warning China that Hong Kong will make its own choices when it comes to Snowden's fate. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
That's this afternoon at 1 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW would like to thank the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.